Understanding China has become more difficult than ever, yet also more important than ever. Whether the U.S. and China are rivals, partners, or a mix of both, effective policy will only be as good as the information on which it is based. My name is Scott Kennedy, and I'm the Senior Advisor and Trustee Chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I also have had the privilege of being one of the few American scholars who has traveled back and forth between Washington and Beijing in recent years. I'm a firm believer that field research, direct observation, talking, and listening to Chinese perspectives must be a part of our toolkit to understand the People's Republic of China. So join me as I speak with Chinese leaders from business, government, and academia, and foreigners who have spent many years living and working in China. What makes China tick? Where is the country going? What connects us? And what divides us? We'll dive into all that and more on this podcast. Welcome to China Field Notes. Welcome to this edition of China Field Notes. I am delighted today to be joined by Yu Tiejun from Peking University, who has been my partner the past year plus in promoting U.S.-China scholarly cooperation. I want to introduce Professor Yu first, and then we're going to have a conversation about U.S.-China relations, scholarly cooperation, the opportunities, the obstacles, where the relationship is going, and what we should be in store for in 2024 and beyond. Yu Tiejun is a professor at Peking University's School of International Studies, and he is now president of the university's Institute of International and Strategic Studies. He was a Fulbright visiting scholar at MIT's Security Studies program in 2018 and 19, and was a visiting scholar at Stanford University and Harvard University in 2005-06. And he's also studied at the University of Tokyo. He is the executive editor-in-chief of China International Strategy Review, and he has written extensively on international security, East Asian international relations, and Chinese foreign and defense policy. In addition to all of that scholarship, he's also a fantastic teacher. He was awarded Peking University's Excellent Teaching Award and Distinguished Research Award in 2010 and 2017, respectively. He is a Beida person through and through. Bachelor's degree, master's, and PhD, all from Peking University. Yu Tiejun, thank you so much for joining us on China Field Notes.
Thank you so much, Scott, for having me here.
Well, the reason that we have this program is to give an American audience, particularly the Washington policy audience, the perspective of people from China or who live in China long term. And I couldn't think of a more appropriate person to talk to the American policy community about U.S.-China relations and scholarly cooperation than you, because you've really embodied U.S.-China scholarly cooperation and reflected the evolution of academic development in China over the last 20 plus years, maybe better than anybody. So I'd like to ask you a personal question about yourself first before we start talking about geopolitics and all of these giant issues, which is, how did you get interested in international affairs and Chinese foreign policy? This is not something that every person in the world gets interested in. A lot of people don't like international relations theory. They don't like geopolitics. They have other pursuits. What drew you to this field?
Well, got all my degrees from Peking University. You can see I'm a quite loyal person to what I have chosen, the specialty or the university. I entered Peking University in 1986 when China was in the golden age of this opening up policy. At that time, everything related to world affairs seems quite attractive to young people. So I have not very much idea about international affairs as a research field, you know, at that time. But because it's international affairs, it's international. So I have chosen that. So very interesting. Interestingly, at that time at Peking University, all subjects, all major research fields related to international, popular among students. Not only international politics, that's my major, the international economy, international law, or international history. So that's why I have chosen. And I'm quite interested, but now I have chosen that. So that's my research field after that.
So I was just curious. So at that time, in addition to taking classes about international relations, did you study foreign languages? Did you go to Western restaurants or restaurants, you know, to try the food of other countries? What were other ways in which you took advantage of this sort of, you know, popular interest in the world?
At that time, we were not so rich to go to the Western restaurant at Beijing. You know, we are poor students. You know, all about the all knowledge is related to foreign affairs. As a China scholars these days, we read reference news like those kind of papers. At that time, there's no obstacles for those kind of for journals that we can read. It's quite extensive at the library. I visit foreign countries. That's first of the foreign country I visit is Japan. That's already in the middle of 1990, 10 years after I entered the university. It's not a very, it's quite still quite rare for students to visit foreign countries at that time. But, you know, after that, when I became a faculty member and China's entering the 21st century, and we have a lot of international communication channels. Also, you know, you mentioned I was a Fulbright and also sponsored by the Chinese government, you know, education fund to study at American universities. So then the visions has been broadened.
Indeed it has. You've accomplished quite a lot between 1986 and 2024. In the blink of an eye, you've come so far. You're now the head of an amazing organization, the Institute of International and Strategic Studies. I don't think a lot of Americans in the policy community who don't work on China and foreign policy know a lot about IISS, but they should. Can you give us a little summary of your institute?
Sure. The Institute of International and Strategic Studies is a university-based small think tank. You know, we established that in the very beginning of 2007 as a Center for International Strategic Studies. CIIS, funded by Professor Wang Zifu, is my teacher and also the Dean of School of International Studies. And he thinks we need to do some thing related to the reality, the real world, you know, to make our research quite relevant to, you know, Chinese foreign policy. He established that center in 2007. And then in 2013, we upgraded the center to an institute. And as you visit or you have visited or North Korea, it's a quite nice place. As a center, university-based small think tank, we are also a branch of as a collaborative unit of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. You know, they had a brief us every 2 months or something in the past. So we are focusing on, you know, world politics. And, you know, most of the research fellows came from School of International Studies, or, you know, they are experts on different areas and countries, Middle East, like African studies, and also, like me, as an international security studies expert. So it's quite a transdisciplinary, multidisciplinary research center. That's what we want to do. We have published both the English journal and the Chinese journal. We have book series, Grand Strategy, published in more than 20 books already, a newsletter to make our research relevant to the policy.
So that makes me want to ask the next question. You know, last year, around this time, we talked about having this pair of conferences first in China and then in the United States as a way to help rebuild scholarly exchange and cooperation and collaboration. And we decided that we were going to have scholars from all different kinds of fields, not just international politics and grand strategy, but historians, economists, sociologists. Why on earth would you be willing to get mixed up with CSIS and me and all of these people from other fields outside of international politics and foreign policy for this project?
You know, the China-U.S. relations has been not good for quite some years. And there's a common concern for the scholars, not only from scholars in our field, but all scholars, I think, related to, you know, many of our faculty members, you know them, they got their degrees from the United States, different, you know, research areas, economics, history, sociology, education. So they are deeply concerned about the deteriorations of bilateral relations and American studies in China and China studies in the United States are facing very difficult situation. So as a center at Peking University to facilitate the international communication, that's one of our functions, is the International Strategic Studies. You know, we have several functions, research, teaching, and facilitate the international cooperations.
I'm deeply appreciative of your commitment to this collaboration. And I know that it must be quite challenging to get it approved for all of the planning, for hosting us, for bringing your delegation to the United States. You know, we finally got together in July at Beida, and you hosted us at the Institute's building, which everyone who goes to Beijing or Beida should go see. It's a really fantastic facility. And then in October, you led the delegation to Washington, D.C. for our second round of meetings. When did you know that the risks and work were worth it, that you had made the right decision to collaborate with us?
I think it's a process. It's hard to say when I realized I made the right decision. But gradually, I think I have made the right decision. You know, in the very beginning, I think maybe you're saying you are similar to me. We are quite cautious and don't know where we can go or what kind of thing we can accomplish through this dialogue. But thanks for the FIS, especially you, very good, you know, arrangement for our schedule for agenda. So first, our pair conferences, first in July at Beida at Peking University at Hoi Institute, and then in October at CSI at DC. After finishing this two rounds of this pair conferences, I think we had made the right decision. I'm not sure at the very beginning, but you know, we are supported by on our side, we are supported by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. You know, we have to finish all the procedures, you know, and also supported by American governments, you know, the border officials, you know, the visa, all these issues are quite smoothly. That's quite surprising and make me think, you know, we have done the right things. After the two rounds of meetings at Beida and Peking University, we also are treated quite well at the China Embassy at DC. It's quite rare for them to do this. I do think we have done the right things. And, you know, our visiting has draw a lot of attention. I don't know how much it was in American side, but on the Chinese side, many of my friends, they got this news, you know, and think, you know, we have done the right things. I have got a lot of congratulations, so you have done the right things. And then we have the high-ranking officials visiting D.C., and then we have, in November, we have the summit meeting in San Francisco. I think the process is quite well. We have done the right things.
I can understand why there's no specific one moment that it takes, that it comes gradually to you. I felt, just from my own opinion, I felt really good about this. I didn't know if it would work out entirely, but I felt really good about this in July when we were sitting down in your institute. And after you and I made some initial opening remarks, everyone else started talking without stop, back and forth, like they hadn't been apart for several years. Some of the people knew each other. Some people did not know each other, yet they were raising their hands, putting up their placards, butting in to offer comments and reactions, all very naturally. And I thought, this is what we should be doing. So obviously that wasn't the end of things. It was just the very beginning. But that made me feel like we were on the right path. Has there been anything about the collaboration or the effort to restart U.S.-China scholarly cooperation that has surprised you?
Yes, just like you, I'm surprised by the immediate emergence of, you know, the sense of comradeship on the same road. So we, among the scholars, we may know each other for quite a long time, or we may met for the first time, but immediately we became friends, and we enjoy the mutual trust based on the same concern for bilateral relations. And based as a scholars and expert, we can communicate really on almost everything we are interested in. We may not agree with each other on all subjects, but we can communicate and let the other side know why the case is like this, the situation is like this, to listen to the complaints of other side quietly and calmly, and try to find some solutions or some understanding for those kind of problems. I think this is the basis of for the people-to-people communication. We should know where the problems lies in the very beginning. So we scholars can do that. I think that's make me, you know, quite so quickly and so immediate. We didn't meet with each other for 3 or 4 years, but you know, once we get together, you know, we are so happy and so freely to communicate, even under the so difficult bilateral relation. We enjoy the trust. That's what made me most surprised still in the hard times of the bilateral relation. It's kind of icy bilateral relationship.
I really appreciate that. I would totally endorse what you just said. You know, I was also impressed that, you know, I was told before we went that in meetings with Chinese scholars or anyone in China, they would be so nervous, untrusting, that you couldn't have a serious conversation and that people would not share their true opinions. And I could tell that that wasn't the case when we met, in particular because Americans disagreed with other Americans and that there was not unanimity amongst the Chinese. There were a whole variety of different points of view. That was particularly surprising and impressive to me, and proof of the value and the genuineness of the conversations. You know, U.S.-China relations are still not very good. They're somewhat stabilized, but still face huge, tremendous difficulties. And the scholarly relationship is also still not normal. There's still big obstacles. What are the sort of top priorities of things that still need to be worked on to bring scholarly interactions back to a more healthy state?
Yes, you know, we initiated this academic communication. I think it's just the beginning. We need more communications among the scholarly communities on both sides. And I really want, you know, this kind of scholarly communication can is a sustainable process. And we can proceed to focusing on more questions that both sides are interested in, and try to find some solutions to help the government to improve the bilateral relations. And secondly, make me nervous and sometimes quite frustrated. We need the cooperation, need the coordinations among different government agencies, I think on both sides, to reduce the obstacles for this communication, scholarly or, you know, ordinary people, the more ordinary people, like the border, not so much, you know, border interrogations, you know, so the delays of and try to reduce, you know, all those kind of obstacles, make people happy to travel, to communicate with the other side. I think that on that point, we need to do more. And thirdly, I think, you know, especially among the media, that's make me worry. On one side, we want to improve the bilateral relations, but on the other side, if you look at the media, so there's still quite a lot of disinformation spread, widespread, both sides. How to cooperate to reduce those kind of disinformation and make the people, the ordinary people, know the real thinking or the reality of the other side. I think we there's still a lot of things we need to do. I think it's just all initiatives are just beginning. I agree with that. Still a lot of things need to be done.
Those are very good proposals and suggestions. The report that we're issuing by CSAS that has contributions from you, some of the other Chinese participants, and some of the American participants in the initiative include a fuller list of proposals. But those sound like very important ones to move forward on all fronts. I hope it's okay if I use this opportunity to ask you about one aspect about current events. Last year, when I was in China and when I traveled elsewhere in Asia and Europe, oftentimes the first question people would ask me was about the U.S. presidential election scheduled to be held in November of 2024. They wanted me to tell them what the outcome would be. Well, my answer has consistently been, I don't know. I'm a China expert, not an America expert. But nevertheless, everyone still always asks me that question. And I assume when I go to China again later this year, and when I travel to other places, people will still ask me. I'll have to give the same answer. That'll be frustrating. And we'll all have to wait until November to see the results, or maybe even longer. Why are people in China so interested in the outcome of the U.S. presidential election?
That's a great question. Yes, I'm also always asked with this same question in China now. You know, and my answer is also, I don't know. I have no ideas about that. So why they ask the questions are always, my understanding is, first of all, leadership is important. For the Chinese people, you know, leadership has been attacked a lot of attention. Now it's the things here on this side, but it also projected to the other side, to the United States. You know, who will be the next president of the United States? So important countries. That's maybe my second point. The first one is leadership is important. They can make big difference. So who will be elected to be the next American president? I think they draw the attention for almost every Chinese, even they are not so closely related to these questions, or you know, in their own line. So my first answer is leadership is important, and secondly is the United States China U.S. relations. People, even they have not very much knowledge about the world affairs, they know the United States is the most powerful countries in this world. The China-U.S. relations is the most important bilateral relations in this world for the Chinese people, for ordinary Chinese. So, and who will be the next president? Thus, you know, will play maybe a very important role in reshaping, in impacting the bilateral relations. So naturally, they are interested in this. And thirdly, I think, you know, the last election is so, you know, it's quite a dramatic election 4 years ago, and got people, you know, very curious about American politics. And that's also, you know, American politics, United States has changed so lot, and the people have no ideas what happened in the United States, you know, reflected in the general election. So they still want to watch it. This kind of dramatic, maybe that continues. It's a very tight, maybe very competitive elections. People don't know the answer. That's quite curious for the Chinese people. I think fundamentally, they think who will be the next American president can impact the bilateral relations. So they think, you know, Trump, whether it's Trump or Biden, they are different. They have different approaches to deal with the bilateral. That's why you are concerned. I also want to ask you the questions what you never told me before the answer.
Well, CSIS is a strictly nonpartisan think tank. But of course, as you said, leadership matters. And whoever assumes the presidency in January of 2025 will still have a big impact on the relationship. And we do know, based on records and what they say, that a second Biden term would be different from a second Trump term in terms of their emphasis domestically and internationally. We can see that. I think the other point that you made about the drama of 2020 is something that gets attention in the United States quite a bit still. It's playing out in our legal system and in our political system. I think most people would like there to be less drama. They're okay with drama on election day. They want less drama in the transition from one administration to the other, and that there's a peaceful transition of power, whoever wins the election. But I got to tell you, everybody is paying attention. And I imagine that people will continue to pay attention throughout this year and up until the next inauguration, a little less than a year from now. It will help that we have resumed scholarly cooperation and exchanges before a dramatic moment like that, because the scholarly collaboration that we have allows us to communicate, explain, analyze what's going on inside both of our societies, which affects the relationship between the two countries as well as global affairs, given how important and large both of our countries are. I really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, all the help.
Thank you so much, Scott, for so many things you have done for cooperation. I want to U.S. elections to go smoothly. And I want to, you know, whoever will be elected president, you know, they can pay, can contribute to a positive, more positive, a more stabilized bilateral relations. You know, people still worry about bilateral relations.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining the podcast, for the collaboration. I hope folks who are listening will read the joint report with the essays from the American and Chinese participants in our initiative and provide feedback and move the relationship forward and help us address the continuing obstacles we have to scholarly cooperation and to the relationship as a whole. Again, thank you for joining us and look forward to our continued collaboration and partnership and friendship.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for listening to China Field Notes. Stay up to date with our latest releases by following us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to great content. Until next time,